Welcome. This is Cascade Church Portland's podcast. We exist to invite all people to join us as we follow Jesus together in bringing heaven to earth.
How many of you remember playing video games on the original Nintendo system? All right, so more people than I thought. Good, good, good. If a game wasn't working correctly, how did you get it to work? Ha! The slap and blow. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, yeah. Slap, you blow on it, put it back in. I love that that's what our technology now. Now everything's reboot. Then a strong breath might just clear it out and you might have a good shot at making it work. So when I grew up, we did not have a Nintendo because 100 bones. Like, who could afford that? Not our family. We didn't have Atari. We didn't have anything. It was a long time before we got like a PlayStation, like several years after it was cool. You know, that Christmas gift where you're really excited, but you still don't really tell your friends about it because they're gonna be like, "I got that like 4 years ago. What are you? Why are you excited about that now?" So I would go over to my friend's house. And I was at the whim of whatever games that she would have. But she had this game that I don't know if anyone remembers called Adventures in the Magic Kingdom. And it was a Disney game where at the beginning of the game you saw, and I had to research this. I don't fully remember all of this. I just vaguely remember like the feelings, the emotions. But you'd start off in the game and you'd see like these little 8-bit Mickey and Donald and Goofy. And they wanted to start a parade in Disneyland, but they couldn't because there were 6 golden keys that were hidden throughout the park. And so you'd have to go onto the different rides in the game, and then you'd do the little challenge, and you could win a key. Now, I was like 8 or 9 years old, and this game became my obsession. If you ever, like, you played a video game, really any video game, and you get really, really obsessively into it, so my MO is like, I could just not play a video game for months and I wouldn't think about it. But then I would start playing a game and I could play for like all day and night, like just not stop. And then I would dream about the game and think about it. This game became an obsession for me because there was all these different levels. So there was like a Thunder Mountain Railroad level that you would go through and you had to like pick the right switchbacks and get faster and faster. There's a Space Mountain one where you had to hit the right button, and I wasn't very good at that one, and I couldn't get it, and I couldn't get it. Weeks and weeks and weeks we worked on it. And finally, together, through our shared ability, and I have to be honest, not owning the video game system, I think I had conquered one of the things that got you one of the 6 golden keys, and she had done the other 5. But we won. We got all 6 keys. And I was so excited. This is what I had been waiting for. The big moment when we won the game. And you know what we saw? This. That's the end of the game. You win the whole thing, and Mickey just talks to you in this little text box, and he says, "You did it." And this is a quote. It feels rude, I'll be honest with you. Goofy just says, "Gee, thanks." That's his direct quote, "Gee, thanks." And I'm like, I have bled for you, Goofy, over weeks. I can't feel my thumbs anymore. I feel like there's a little bit more gratitude. And then it just does that. There's not even like in Mario Brothers, you have like the little, you know, the fireworks. Like there's something. And there was just nothing. Nothing. What it got me thinking about is when we in life, when we have like these journeys or these quests or these things that we go on, we kind of have expectations on what it's going to feel like or what it's going to be like when we get there. It's going to look like this. It's going to feel like this. It's going to have... I didn't know what I was expecting. If you would have asked me what it was, I don't know that I could have said it. But when I experienced that, I was like, this stinks. This is not what I was looking for. This wasn't what I was hunting after. There was an article at the beginning of the current NFL football season that was this whole spotlight on Aaron Rodgers. It's a fascinating read. Aaron Rodgers is a quarterback for the Green Bay Packers. And a number of years ago, they won the Super Bowl. And he tells the story of getting onto the team bus after they won the Super Bowl. And he just had this great feeling. This might be the only time in either of our lives Aaron Rodgers and I have shared a similar experience. He had an experience like I did after the Adventures in the Magic Kingdom. That's it? Now, mine was literally just 8 bits of the end. His was thousands of people cheering and confetti falling from this huge stadium. And I think he won the MVP that year. He got a trophy, like a big trophy, and he still had this sense of, this is it. This is it. I think it helps us ask some questions about life and journeys and the things that we're doing, and to be able to say, usually we can get obsessed about our own lives, our own journeys, the things that we're doing at home, at work, in our relationships, and we're in them. We're like 8-year-old Kurt Kroon, having dreams about it, obsessing about it, putting all your time and effort and energy into it. And the question is, at the end of whatever this is, are you going to find what you're looking for? What are you looking for? Now, I want to acknowledge something before we go any further. When we just did the prayer time, and, you know, well, you were all here for it, for the communion. And I said, like, we take this moment to sit and be set and to say, where am I today and where am I going? I don't just say that. I pray that. And in my prayer time, just now, I just got like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to ask this question right now. I don't know. So, as we go into this, I just want to acknowledge, as we have these conversations, it's an invitation to say, to look at your life, to look at this whole thing that we call life, and look at who God is and who Jesus is inviting us to, these big things. You might be here this morning and be like, I don't want to do this right now. That's okay. Take as much from this as you can hear today. Take as much of this introspection and space that you can handle today. But the invitation for all of us is, let's ask some real questions about who we are. That's kind of what church is for. And the way that we're going to get here, the journey that we're going to walk, is we're going to walk in the Christmas story, the story of the wise men, the magi, these travelers from the east. And to say, what were they looking for? What was the system they came into? And what did they walk away with as a hope in us asking that same question about our story? So, if you have your Bible, I encourage you to turn to Matthew. We're going to be looking at Matthew 2. One of the things that's interesting, there's an assumption that all these stories of Jesus, there's 4 that we have in the Bible, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Mark doesn't have any of this. Did you know? None of this. So, like, it just starts with a full-grown Jesus. John, as we're going to look next week, starts in a very different way. It's like this beautiful poem. It's the thing we're going to talk about, the Word made flesh. It's kind of started in John. Only Luke and Matthew get into the birth story of Jesus, and only Matthew tells about the wise men, talks about the magi. It's interesting to note that this is a unique story. It just happens in Matthew. So in Matthew, Jesus has been born. The shepherds have come and visited. Mary's treasured all these things in her heart. They're there. If you remember, they're not from Bethlehem. They've traveled there because the Caesar, the Roman leader, and Rome owns everything. They're operating what they call the Pax Romana, the peace through Rome, which means everything will be peaceful unless you cross one of our soldiers, and then we'll kill you. And specifically, if you threaten the Roman government, is a little foreshadowing for what happens later. Death through crucifixion was a great way of making public display of what happens to those that cross Rome, that threatens Rome's peace. So this is the system. This is the environment that the story of Jesus comes into. They're still in Bethlehem. They haven't been able to leave yet, which is interesting. The text doesn't say to question, is this because they just had a baby and they decided to extend their stay? Or is this a further stress of government control? Has the Rome said, nope, everyone just stay put. We're still taking the census. It's going to take a while. Think about that being at the whim of another system that you are not in control of, that is telling you where you can live, where you can go, and what you can do. And how do you survive for any length of time when you're that separate from your work, from where you're all the stuff that you do back home? The reason why I say all that is we have to get in touch with the insecurity and the uncertainty that was ever present in the time of Jesus. It was something that was palpable. And it's not something that we experience a lot in North America. Well, we do, but it's not always as imminent. So, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. That's an interesting line that I hadn't noticed before. So a couple of things to set the context. If you see any map of the Middle East, you have up in the north, you have the Sea of Galilee. This is the stories of Jesus and his disciples crossing over the sea in the boat. That's the Sea of Galilee. You have the Jordan River moves down, then you got the big Dead Sea. The Dead Sea is the Dead Sea because there are no outlets. That's where everything stops. That's why it has all this high salinity, which means lots and lots of salt. It's feeding into, but it doesn't go anywhere. So what's interesting is in the Sea of Galilee, there are hundreds and hundreds of species of fish, some that only appear in the Sea of Galilee. There's nothing in the Dead Sea. It's where stuff goes to die. Nazareth is up by the Sea of Galilee. This is where Jesus is born. But he has to travel all the way down the Jordan River south, and down there is Jerusalem, which is the Jewish center of life, religion. It's where the temple is. It's where everybody does stuff. And Bethlehem is a tiny little nothing town just outside of that. I've used this analogy before, but it still works. Jerusalem is Portland. Bethlehem is Estacada. It's there. It's around there. And Paul, I'm not trying to bash Estacada. But not many people around, like there's no TV show called Estacadia, you know what I mean? Like, it's not a part of the cultural consciousness in the same way that Portland is. So the Magi, when they're traveling, when they're following the star, they're not going to Bethlehem, they're going to Jerusalem. Now, when we say King Herod, king of what? Where did this king come from? If you are the world's biggest military superpower and you're trying to operate this huge kingdom over big swaths of land, you can't just do it by having a king that's there. You have to send out the power. And so what they would do is they would find the people within the different areas that could be a king of that region, but they're working for the Caesar. They're working for Rome. And there was a lot of perks and privileges that came with that, but the huge detriment to that is if there was any respect for you among your own people, you wave goodbye to that when you aligned yourself with Rome. You could be Jewish and you could say, no, we are going to stay with what it means to be in the Israelite nation. There's going to be a resistance to this Roman occupation. And we're going to be here. We're not so big that we think we can win a battle, but we're going to fight it every step along the way. And I encourage you, if you're interested in this, you should read about the Maccabean Revolt. It happens just a little bit before the time of Jesus. There is an actual war. The Israelites try to battle against Rome. What's fascinating is they think they're winning for a while. Because what they don't know is that there's a battle for power in Rome, so they stop sending all their soldiers to just destroy this insurrection because they're having their own battle in Rome. And they're like, we're winning. We did it. We freaked them out. They're not going to come battle us. So again, there's this instability. And what would happen is if you would align yourself with Rome, you would get this power, but you were kind of hated around the area. Now, if you're in Jerusalem, your impact is there's enough money, there's enough power being sent to Herod that he can distribute it to his family and to the people closest to him. And it makes a lot of sense to surround yourself with people who think you're awesome. And they may not think you're awesome because of, you know, your character or integrity. They think you're awesome because you have power to share with them. So it's very much like a sycophant. You're surrounded with people who are like, you're great because they're on your payroll. Because if they're not a part of theirs, they're going to be crushed or they're going to be killed. And as we're going to see, Herod is not a confident king. This Roman occupation creates great insecurity among leadership. So leaders from the east, they come to Jerusalem, because that's the big city. They go meet with Herod. So if they can go and meet with Herod, who might be a small king, a little k king, but he's still a king, these are obviously important people. Do you know what I mean? You don't show up from Omaha and say, I'd like to meet with the mayor of Portland. You can say that. You just probably won't get a meeting with the mayor of Portland. But if certain people show up, the mayor is going to be aware of their presence and is going to want to meet with them. So even just the fact that they meet with Herod says something about these people traveling from the east. They have power. Continuing on in verse 4. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. In Bethlehem, in Judea, they replied, for this is what the prophet has written, but you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. So if you remember at the end, it says Herod's troubled by the fact that these kings, these wise men from the east have come, and they're saying, hey, we hear a king's going to be born here. It says he's troubled and all Jerusalem is troubled, because this is a threat to his little fiefdom. His rule of that is given to him by Caesar, it threatens that. And so he's like, what are these people talking about? And he brings in, this is important, he brings in the religious leaders of the day. This new king, this strong Messiah that's going to lead the Israelite people to freedom, where is it prophesied he's going to come from? And they say, Estacada, Bethlehem. And there's the prophecy by saying, hey, Bethlehem, you may think you don't matter in the big scheme of things, but something massive is coming out of you, this new king, this new leader. I think it's fascinating that the religious leaders of the day are being used by the king of the day to move forward his own agendas. And in this place, as we're going to see, protect his own tenuously held power. King Herod doesn't have a strong grip on power. It's given to him and can be taken away from him. So he is fighting like mad to hold on to it. And the story of a baby being born is a terrifying threat to him. This is why this is important. In our own lives and the lives of people around us, when we live in a system of fear and scarcity, complete non-threats can be the most threatening thing we've ever heard. You have worked at places that are playing out a little like this, where the people in charge are afraid of being fired or that their power or leadership can be taken from them at any point, and anything can be a threat. I'm only saying this because it was just Christmas. If you've ever seen the movie Elf, in Elf, there's the store manager up top. And do you remember what he says when Buddy the Elf decorates the whole store and he makes it all the snowflakes and all that? He says, this is not good news that someone did this. Corporate sends someone because they think we're failing. So everyone keep an eye out for the leaks. Everyone keep an eye out for the moles. The idea in the movie is that Buddy the Elf, a sweet elf, he just decorated because he loves Christmas. And yet, to a person in power that is in a scarcity position, this is a threat to their kingdom. The reason why I say this is when you encounter people like this, logic doesn't really seem to rule the day. You're not going to be able to logic out of it because everything in the system can be a threat. Everyone around them can take that power away because it's not held strongly. Continuing on in verse 7. We skipped to verse 8. That's my bad. Here's what I want you to note from this section. I apologize. There is a disruption coming to this system. The birth of Jesus represents a disruption, and it's not just felt by Herod. It's felt in all of Jerusalem, and this disruption is necessary for there to be peace. A lot of times in our own lives, we want change, we want growth, we want peace, we want joy, we want these great things, but we just hope that we can kind of ease into those things. We just hope that peace and joy is going to be like an addition that we add into our lives, but we don't count the cost that usually those things come via major disruptions. The birth of Jesus represented a major disruption to Herod and to all of Jerusalem. A baby being born represented this huge threat. The reason why I say this is there's times in our lives where we're going through life and we experience a major disruption. A loss of job, a loss of a friendship. Something doesn't go right. We feel huge pressures at work or we feel huge pressures at home. And we immediately ask, what went wrong? What awful thing has happened to cause this? We're constantly looking for answers. And if I can just decode life, if I can just figure out what causes the bad things, then I can eliminate them and life can be better. But sometimes we need to sit at peace with the disruptions of life, especially those that are not of our own creation. Because those disruptions can lead to greater peace. Those disruptions can lead to greater joy. There's not a single story you've ever read that's worth writing or reading that doesn't deal with some kind of disruption. There's not a movie that you have seen that doesn't deal with some sort of conflict or some sort of strife or something that goes wrong. Now, you can say, well, that's just because Hollywood wants to make money and those are the stories they tell. No. This has been a common thread throughout all of humanity. The stories we tell one another aren't the stories where everything goes smoothly. They're the stories of disruption. And yet, when we experience disruption in our own lives, we don't know what to do with it. We can't see on the other side of it. We can't see how it can lead to something better, how there can be joy and how there can be peace on the other side of it. It's blinding, the disruptions are. Imagine you were a family that lived in this time. And the way that this story goes, if you're unfamiliar, is Herod is so threatened, he has every baby born within the time. That's why he asked the Magi when they first saw the star appear. From that time until the time that it is, every boy born within that time killed. There's no one that was alive in Bethlehem during that time that thought, it's great news, Jesus is here. There's no mother that watched her son being killed that thought, oh, finally our Messiah is here. It was just grief. It was just suffering. It was just a massive disruption to everything. Now, I want to be clear about this. I'm not saying that God gets bored with the peaceful lives that we live and creates disruptions into them so we can get sad and he's going to bring something better out of it. I don't think we put the actions of a petty tyrant at the feet of God. People are massively insecure and people reject the truth of God to be lived and driven by fear, to be lived and driven by scarcity. And to hold on to things that are not theirs to hold, and they do awful things out of it. But the story we see over and over again in the story of God is that God's not going to allow those awful things to stay awful. God's not going to allow disruptions to go unresurrected, unreconciled, unrestored. God is constantly at work, and there is no amount of hardship and suffering that you have gone through, that you are in right now, or you will go through, that God can't bring something beautiful out of. When we're in them, we mourn them. We don't stop being sad about them because God's going to bring something good. You don't weep your baby boy killed by King Herod because Jesus is here. Are you with me? We weep that. That will forever be evil. That will forever be awful. And yet, we don't stay there. We don't live there because we know that this God is at work. I think we need to change our relationships with the disruptions in our lives. Not to call them good, to understand them as evil, but to always see that God is moving and working through these things, and it's not the end of the story. I want to go back to the Magi for a second. So imagine that they are studying the stars. They're noticing things that are going on. They are in another whole area of the world. They're not Israelites. I feel like for you it might be obvious, but they're not Israelites. They didn't come see Jesus because Jesus was going to be their king. They came and recognized there was this thing happening in this other group of people, the Jews, that they were interested in. And they saw the star and they pursued it and say, what is going on here? The question is, when they saw the star and they set out on the journey, which is a kind of amazing phenomenon, I would imagine there's not a lot of people that could raise their hand like, no, I've seen some strange things in the sky and packed up and traveled across the country to pursue them. Just because it happened in the Bible and we talk about it like it's a thing doesn't mean it's normal. This is weird. That's why they wrote it down. I like to say that a lot. We don't write down the normal stuff. The stuff in the Bible, don't nod your head and be like, yeah, that makes sense. No, it doesn't. That's why they wrote it down. Because it's a story we're telling. People picking up and noticing a star and like, huh, let's see if a baby's been born. That's not normal. The question is, when they started their journey, what did they expect to find? What did they expect to be their part in this story? Did they know that their participation in the story also contributed to something pretty awful happening in this area? And one of the questions I want us to ask ourselves by thinking of what were they seeking after? What were they looking for? Is to be able to ask ourselves in our own lives, what are you looking for in life, here in church? You're here this morning. I don't mean this in a rude way, like I don't want you here. Very grateful for all of you. Why are you here? What are you looking for? What are you seeking after? And I want to look at four different possibilities. And I only look at them as possibilities. There might be another one that I don't name that better describes you, but this might help you round down some of the understandings. Are you seeking after comfort? In life, are you saying, I seek to live a life where I'm comfortable? I want vehicles or transportation that will be reliable. I want a bank account that will have enough money in it that I can suffer some unexpected costs and it won't bankrupt me. I want to have enough relationships where I feel known and comfortable and have someone to call if I get lonely. I don't want so many relationships where I feel like I'm burdened by other folks. I want a kind of job that is interesting and stretches me, but not too stretching, not too overwhelming. What I'm looking for in life is the Goldilocks kind of life. I'm looking for just right. Interesting enough that I want to show up to it, not so interesting that I obsess over it. Some of us, we would never say that going into it, but if we look back, the tape of our lives would demonstrate that's our orientation. That's what we're looking for. Is that what you're seeking after? Are you seeking after success? Some of us are driven by succeeding. And if we're not succeeding, then we just change the rules of the game. We're looking for wins. We're looking for little tally marks to put up on the scoreboard of life. Whatever it is. In work, we're climbing some sort of ladder. We're moving on to some different success. We're seeing our bank accounts climb. We're participating in life in some way. Even this last week, I apologize if this is like too, you're like, stop it. One of the things I love to do after Christmas, I love to make puzzles. Just putting together a puzzle. I don't know, it's just fun. And as I was putting together the puzzle, I thought, I know, this is where it gets weird. What is work? Why do some people get paid to do certain things? Like I get it. I think whatever they do generates enough interest or money in some way that it's worth compensating. But when someone puts together a puzzle, you're like, some of you are like, awesome, sounds fun, can I come over? Some of you are like, that's a colossal waste of time. Why are you doing that? But isn't everything a puzzle? Isn't everything, we're just doing the thing. Everything's kind of a video game. We're just tracking different successes. We're just tracking different achievements. There's just different things we want to succeed at whatever it is. And working a job and getting paid at the end of the week and putting the last piece in a 1,000-piece puzzle is kind of the same thing. This is what I do when there's lots of snow and I'm not working. Are you chasing after success, however you define it? Are you seeking after that? Are you seeking after adventure? It doesn't matter what it is. You just want it to be new. I want new experiences. I want to meet new people. I want new things. Nothing in life is as thrilling for you as opening something up that's never been opened before. Going somewhere you've never been before. Pulling a tag off a coat, getting on an airplane, opening up and smelling that new car smell. You just want something new, something adventurous, something different. Sometimes when you drive home, you're like, I'm going to a different gas station today because life is wild. You want adventure. Are you seeking after truth? And I don't use this just in a traditional kind of the Christian way of talking about truth is like, then you're seeking after the truth. No, I mean truth as a concept where you experience the world as being some kind of squishy, that the rules seem to change and that these people succeed and these people don't. These people are happy and these people aren't. And like, I read that Aaron Rodgers article that I just recently heard about and he didn't seem happy. And what is that? What you're seeking after is that there's some solid ground somewhere in this world. And if I can just find that, it will give me a foundation on which to build my life. It'll give me a place to feel solid and grounded and that the game won't change. It's not like going back to a video game. You play a video game and you're just doing this one thing over and over and you're accumulating coins and then the time runs out and you're dead. Like, well, the point wasn't accumulating coins. You had to get to the end of the level. You're looking for what's the point. You know what I mean? There's a lot of 80s video games referenced today. I apologize. You're looking for what's the point? What's the truth? What's the reason why I'm here and what am I supposed to do? And sometimes in our quest after truth, we'll just take anyone's certainty. Someone being really certain about something is a good substitute for truth. Because we just want something with conviction, something with heft, something with depth. What are you seeking after? Maybe it's a combination of a couple of those. Maybe it changes seasonally or weekly or daily for you. But as you go on this adventure of life, like the Magi packed up and headed to go to this town of Jerusalem and then to Bethlehem, it's important to ask, what are you seeking after? What are you searching for? Let's continue on in the story. We're going to read Matthew 2, 8 through 12. This is Herod. It said, he sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him. That's a lie. After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star that they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. Continuing on, it says, on coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshiped him. It's a fascinating response to a baby with a mother. They bowed down and worshiped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. A couple of things that are really interesting. If you're interested, you can do the research on the different gifts and their significances. They're interesting gifts to give to a baby, and they definitely play a role later in the life of Jesus and understanding kind of what they are. They're really extravagant gifts. Also, fun fact, if you're looking for myrrh, Wing Ming Herbs on 82nd sells it. You can go get it. I bought it a couple years ago just to see what it was like. Sap. They are seeking after Jesus. And I wonder what went through their head when they got to the place where Mary and Joseph and Jesus were staying. Was it the adventures in the Magic Kingdom? Were they like, this is it? It must be the wrong address. We got to find a different place. And when they walked in and saw Mary and Joseph, there's nothing about the description or information that we have on them that these are kingly or stately people that you would walk in and go, oh, my goodness. A young teenage mother and Mary, Joseph, a carpenter, these were the parents of the Messiah, the chosen one. Another thing that's interesting, and this is a theme that happens a lot in the Bible, they walk through the door, which is a powerful statement. They show up and they walk through the door. And when they see Jesus, they worship him. Reminder, they're not Jewish. The ability to spot truth, the ability to spot God in the world, isn't limited to just people with the right name attached to their beliefs or their convictions. God is speaking loudly to these folks. And this is the other thing I think is fascinating. They go back home. They deliver the gifts. They worship him. And then they say, time to be heading back east. Have a great day. They don't stay there. They don't say, I don't know, what are you doing the next 30 years? Let's see how this thing turns out. They just go back home. And given life expectancy in that day, for them to have risen to this level of prestige where they can go and immediately see Herod, they can have these kinds of gifts with them, usually communicates a kind of age that they've worked to a certain point in life. They probably don't see what happens with Jesus. They probably don't know what becomes of him. They have this amazing experience of seeing Jesus, and that compels them to go live the rest of their lives. There's another story in the Bible, the Transfiguration, where Jesus is transfigured before them, and he appears with the heroes of the Jewish story. And Peter, one of the disciples, is like, let's build huts. Let's Airbnb this thing. We got to stay here forever. And Jesus says, no. It's time to go. It's time to move again. Whatever you're seeking after in life, it's not a destination. The Magi found it. They got to the end of the rainbow, and then they went home. Who Jesus Christ is, the God of the universe, creating us and making us specifically you. You're the only you that has ever existed and will ever exist. And calling you into being is a life of action and movement. It's not arriving. And we have these moments where we're incredibly grateful for, where we see the face of God in Jesus Christ. And Jesus Christ is reflected back to us in the lives of people around us. We have this sacred and spiritual experience in church or in nature or somewhere, and we say, wow, okay, time to go home. Time to take this experience, this disruption of Jesus into a system where he changed everything, and we take it with us. We move forward with it. I don't want to be too negative at the end of 2017, but maybe it's appropriate. Whatever you're seeking after, it's not a destination. This week, my son, who just turned 7, said, Dad, how do you get to the end of the rainbow? And I said, okay, well, so usually there's like no sunlight when it's raining. And then sometimes the sunlight's out, but it's too hot and then you can't have rain. But when you have rain and sunlight at the same time, it reflects light and then it creates this view, this rainbow. So it's just something you see. It's not something you can touch. Okay, Dad. But what do you do when you get to the end of the rainbow? It was clear. He's like, oh, gosh, Dad didn't get it. No. The end of the rainbow. Many of us are seeking after the end of the rainbow. And we're just sure we can find it. If we get there, we're going to see it and it's going to make sense and life is going to fall into place. It's a bit of a fool's errand. And if we call these folks the wise men, it might be true to say, oh, maybe in life, these adventures, these journeys that we're on, the things that we're seeking after is just a place to visit. It's not a place to camp. And how do I live my life with this awareness that it's always unfolding? It keeps on going. We put less of our effort into arriving somewhere. We put more of our effort in being aware of where we are today. We're more aware of the trajectories we're called upon, the paths that we're called upon, the ways we live into disruption and bring peace. Where we mourn in times of suffering and we see joy and beauty brought out of that. And we're less interested in how do we just create the beauty? How do we just make that a place where everyone can live and I can be all the time? If you're orienting your life around comfort, you're never going to find it. If you're orienting your life around adventure, it's a finite earth. There's only so much adventure to have. If you're orienting around success, there's only so much success to have. If we stop and we break the cycle and we see, oh, there's something else to be found, I think it can reorient our hearts, our minds, and it can change the way we engage in a new year tomorrow. Would you pray with me? God, I thank you that you are the God that doesn't sit outside of disruption, of pain, of suffering, and invites us to get away and create more safety, more seclusion from the dangerous world. But God, you are the God that came into the disruption of the world. From the earliest moments of your story, God, you were witness to violence, fear, death. And God, you brought great hope from that place. God, I pray that we would be able to reorient our hearts from thinking that we can reach some sort of destination where we will be happy. Instead, we can see it's an unfolding journey that is led by you. As God, you are the one who knows us better than we could know ourselves, created us. God, the only one able to call us fully into who we've been created to be. God, I pray that we would be seeking after you. We would be asking different questions about our stories, our lives, the decisions, and where we're going. And God, we would be unafraid when we have these moments where your world breaks into our world and we see it's all one, that we don't have to camp there or stay there. But we can continue on in the journey, treasuring these things in our hearts, but continuing to move on. It's in your name that we pray. Amen. So like the Magi, would you stand to be sent? You look particularly wise this morning. And if anybody has any frankincense and myrrh, come talk to me. May you go into 2018... aware that in the midst of disruptions, God brings beautiful things out of those places. May you not fall into the trap of the end of the rainbow, but see that God is inviting us into a journey that is constantly moving and constantly changing. And that doesn't have to fill us with fear. It can fill us with hope. Amen and amen. Have a great end of your year.